There is this general wish to live in a more livable city and a city made more for people and less for cars. I need to be able to kind of reflect on what we're doing and feel that it's meaningful. I would personally never want to run a company myself. So I think for me it's very important to have great partners along for the journey. The world certainly needs more female founders, there's no doubt about that. The thing that I enjoy the most is we have such amazing people on the team. We've made no compromises. We've just hired the best people.
Welcome to a new episode of Beauty and Beyond with conversations about change, beauty, health, and entrepreneurship. This time we talk about the beauty of mobility. As some of you might know, I spent 4 years in the automotive industry, an industry which is in full transformation, going well beyond cars. In fact, it is all about mobility in a world where sustainability and healthy lifestyle play a dominant role. I'm very happy to welcome Erik Quidenius-Walfors. He is the co-founder of Dance, a startup dedicated to electrical mobility to make our cities more livable. Before that, he co-founded SoundCloud, one of the most successful music platforms. Hello, Erik.
Hello. Pleasure to be on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining. So let's talk about mobility. How do you see the transformation of mobility in our cities over the last years?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're at an interesting time right now. Cities are changing. And as we've seen also through the pandemic, cities are changing at a rapid pace. Some cities are really taking kind of leadership here. I'm actually now in Paris, and I was in Paris the last time in 2017. And then coming back here, it's just incredible to see the transformation that has occurred with the leadership of Anne Hidalgo. The city has become, you know, a haven for bikes, really, and people using micromobility, electric, you know, light electric vehicles in many shapes and forms. And that's, you know, very inspiring, I think, for me to see that a city like Paris, which is obviously has existed for a long time, can change so quickly. There's been a lot of infrastructure built here in a short period of time. And I think that's a big inspiration for us and for me. And I think just in terms of how cities need to change, of course, cars are now being electrified, right? So we're seeing more and more electric cars on the street. But my view is that this is not enough, right? We also need other ways of getting around the cities, and we need, you know, smaller vehicles in the cities. We have issues with congestion, you know, noise, pollution, and safety in cities. This is the general direction, I think.
And did the pandemic in some way help to see this transformation happening faster?
I think interestingly, it's one of the positive side effects of the pandemic. It's really been a catalyst for change here. So e-bikes were already, you know, and other electric vehicles were already kind of on a great sort of trajectory before the pandemic. And then what happened during the pandemic is a lot of cities realized that, you know, the best sort of socially distanced way to get around cities, the most scalable way, is by using smaller vehicles. And e-bikes as a kind of technology has been really well positioned there. So this has definitely led to rapid, like more rapid change in many cities. And that continues. And of course, the bigger overarching reason to do this for many cities is climate change, right? So I think we will see this continue.
And is it climate change or also on top a healthier lifestyle? Because mobility and with regard to bicycle or electrical bicycle mobility, in my view, it also has to do with lifestyle. The non-electrical part is even healthier. But still, I think it's a new feeling of, how to move, how to get mobile.
Definitely. I mean, I think there are a number of kind of trends and issues in play here. I think, I mean, for us, it's obviously the big mega trend of people not wanting to own vehicles, and certainly not heavier vehicles, bigger vehicles like a car. and people not necessarily even getting a driver's license these days. And then there's a big health trend. There is this general wish to live in a more livable city and a city made more for people and less for cars. E-bikes are, by the way, pretty much on par with bikes in terms of their health benefits. So people end up using e-bikes more and they ride longer and more frequently. And so the benefits have been proven now in a few studies to be very similar as with regular bikes.
That's interesting, yeah. Because when I use an e-bike, I try to avoid to put the electric on. So I try to move on my own. And you are right, you use it most probably more often. But coming from SoundCloud to dance, it has all to do with music. Yeah? So you are kind of a music man. So what is dance all about and why is it called dance?
Yeah. So my journey, you know, in a very short recap is I used to do internet stuff for a long time. And then, you know, eventually I did a bunch of music as well. And so I eventually started SoundCloud with my friend Alex. And then I did that for about 12 years. But actually around the time of the Paris Agreement, I got very much into climate change and started reading about this topic and, you know, shifted some of my personal investing activity into climate tech and climate impact. And then over time, I found myself more and more pulled into sort of that direction. And I ended up stepping down from SoundCloud early 2019. And then I spent the better part of 2019 looking at what could be next. And my focus was climate tech only. So I, you know, explored a bunch of different things, turned many stones. I met many people and eventually found this, you know, the space of micromobility, which I had been interested in for a while, but sort of the specifically e-bikes, and then specifically had this idea of e-bike subscription. And then through that, I met Christian, who it turned out he had the same idea. And so the both of us, you know, got together and we really hit it off and started exploring, you know, e-bikes and then subscription e-bikes, and then got very excited about the whole thing. And so that's how it started. And for me, a lot of it was about thinking about who am I and how could I spend, you know, the next 10, 20 years of my life in the best way possible with my sort of passion, skill set, you know, background and ambition.
And the name Dance?
The name Dance. So that was, you know, intense brainstorming for a number of weeks. We were bouncing lots of different ideas. We had, you know, we had several code names for the project before we settled on Dance. Dance was sort of one of the names that were floating around. You know, we thought initially that this was going to be hard to copyright. It was almost felt, or to trademark it, right? So, so that was one initial concern. But we generally really liked the idea of just something light and simple. You know, something fun. So dance for me is just, you know, joyful movement and just having fun while actually moving. And so, and then also, I think in terms of the idea, it's a big choreography, right? So it's a big, you know, everyone moving in the city feels a bit like a big choreographed sort of dance. And then also what we do in the background is, of course, dancing around, making sure that these bikes are all working, you know, perfectly for the customer. So hence the name Dance, yeah.
So dancing with the bikes or dancing with the bike. But here, in that sense, it's also all about a product. It's not just a platform. It's not just tech. It's also tech, but it's about a very, very practical and workable product. Yeah. So, and that was different from SoundCloud, definitely. So, and how did you approach this? So you said, okay, we need to invent our own bike. And how the first steps, how did that happen?
Yeah, so exactly. I mean, one thing about SoundCloud was it was a very abstract product, right? And I ran the product team, the tech team there. And it, you know, in the end, it was just this orange icon on your phone, right? And you know, very virtual product, which now it's really refreshing, of course, to have something that you can see and touch and kind of actually use and see on the streets and things like that. So that's been really fun. I think for me also, when we looked at the space, one of the things we realized fairly quickly was that there simply isn't a bike that you can get that is tailored for subscription. So there's a lot of activity in shared micromobility. So you have all kinds of form factors, e-bikes, you know, scooters, all kinds of things going on there. But they're generally very heavy, sort of heavy-duty vehicles designed to sustain the elements, to sustain vandalism and things like this. And so it's not a very nice vehicle to own yourself. And then, of course, in owned mobility, there are a lot of bikes being built there. But what we realize is that you need to combine all of the technology, you know, like connectivity and sensors and thoughts around sustainability or longevity of the vehicles, combine that from sharing with all of the benefits of an owned vehicle. So we ended up designing a new vehicle from scratch. And that's, of course, one of the things that got us excited is we can also reinvent the bike, right? So we can think about what needs, you know, what does a bike need to be in the 2020s.
So if I have to take the decision to buy an e-bike or subscribe to your service, what is the advantage to subscribe?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the original impulse here was a really simple one. It's the fact that e-bikes are sort of taking over all of bikes, especially for like urban mobility. Everything is eventually going to be pretty much electric bikes because they're just that much better. It's not only about them being faster and, you know, easier to get around. It's also the fact that it's an electric vehicle means you can put technology into the vehicle, safety features, etc. And so those vehicles are kind of generally taking over. The issue is, of course, that if you're buying now an e-bike, it's an expensive purchase decision. So it's, you know, 2,500 euro or more, right? Can easily be 5,000 euro. So it's a big purchase decision. The market is quite fragmented. There's a lot of things out there and it's a fast moving market. So next year, you know, the batteries will be better, the technology will be better. And so there's this sense that if I buy something today, I'm not sure if it's going to be great, you know, next year because there's a faster pace of change. So you have that issue around kind of the purchase decision. And then if you own an e-bike, you now own this complex electric vehicle that needs servicing, that tends to break, you know, occasionally, and then break in ways that are way more complex than a regular bike, right? So you can't just bring it to your nearest bike shop, to a mechanic, and they will look at it and maybe they are able to fix it. But sometimes, you know, there's a complex problem with the electrical, you know, propulsion or whatever it might be. And so they need to order spare parts. They wait, you know, for 2 months to just to get the part and so on. And then, of course, there's theft, right? So these vehicles can also get stolen. And that's then a huge pain. So the experience of owning a bike, I think in general, and specifically e-bikes, is not great, right? And so our idea was, how can we address this? So what Dance is, you know, it's an e-bike subscription. You pay per month. You have full flexibility. We deliver it to you, you know, anytime, any place. You have an app. If anything happens to the bike, if it breaks, if it gets stolen, you push a button, and typically within hours, like it's within 24 hours, but typically during business hours, we fix it the same day. And so it's like streaming a bike, right? It's like music streaming or video streaming, but for a vehicle. So you just you have the vehicle, you know it's always there, it always works. You know, and contrast that, you know, in Berlin, where I live, for example, during springtime, so right about now, everyone goes to the bike shop and everyone wants their bike fixed. And so then you come to the bike store and they will put your, you know, name on a piece of paper or phone number and they call you back in 3 weeks and say, hey, maybe, you know, your bike is ready now, right? So that's the kind of typical customer experience for bikes. It's just pretty antiquated and not great.
And isn't it a challenge to really guarantee the service?
I mean, this is sort of more than half of our business in a sense, right? We've designed a vehicle, but we've also designed a whole machine around the vehicle, right? So a lot of our software efforts and, you know, other things that we're doing is really around the warehouses, our operation, logistics. You know, we're heavily using software every step of the way, sort of in operations and logistics. So this is a big focus of ours, and making the bike easily serviceable, making it possible to train people easily to service the bike. So it's very different from, you know, the challenge of a bike store where you just have all kinds of bikes and you need a kind of general, you know, bike mechanic person, actually kind of a highly skilled person. So we think we can scale this and continue the good level of service.
Mm. And the attention, or I described it in the entrance, to make the city more livable. So when you talk about your dream city, the city you want to live in, is Berlin already the city from that perspective you have in your mind?
I think, you know, cities like Amsterdam and Copenhagen come to mind, where more than 50% of people get around by bike, and that actually is increasing, still on an increasing trend. If you're, you know, ever been in Amsterdam recently, it's just wonderful because you have a very quiet city, a walkable city, you know, with, you hear this sort of constant swishing around of bikes in the background, but it's like it feels like it's people, right? And it's you know, and it's a green city. So I think, you know, a lot of other cities are waking up to that, and it's a transformation that needs to happen. I think Berlin is not there. I think Berlin has areas where it's pretty great, and there are initiatives like Kiez Block, for example, in Berlin, where people are trying to create this sort of walkable neighborhoods and you know, bring more micro mobility. But I think it's a you know, for Berlin specifically, we have some ways to go.
And when we talk about sustainability, we talk about a conception of a city with regard to, you mentioned Copenhagen. So the business model as such, besides the target to create a livable city, but is that a business model which is where you can make profit at the end of the day?
Well, I mean, so subscription businesses are very powerful businesses, right? So we have this concept of recurring revenues. So just every month, if we serve our customers well, we get, you know, predictable monthly revenues. If you contrast that to someone selling bikes, you have to sell new bikes to new people sort of every season. And it's unpredictable. It's more, you know, you have more seasonal swings and you have more unpredictability in the business. So if you can scale a subscription business, it's very powerful. We did it with SoundCloud, and we have, you know, millions of people paying for SoundCloud, and that's, you know, a great business if you can build one. It's very different from selling something, and it's quite hard to do it well. I think people think of it, oh yeah, it's just recurring monthly billing, but it's much more than that, because you need to have this ongoing customer relationship. You know, you need to get very good at it, how to win back customers, and you know, how to find the customers, and, you know, do partnerships, do the right sort of bundlings and offerings. So this goes very deep, you know, in terms of subscription businesses. And then if you can make that work, then it's for us, of course, all about operational efficiency. And then making sure that our hardware engineering is really solid and great quality, but not too expensive. And so if we get those pieces in place, it's a very attractive business to be in.
And when you founded this new startup, now from a more theoretical perspective, how much time do you give yourself and your co-founders to reach a break even?
I think, you know, as similarly as with many other companies, it's a bit of a question where there is, you know, different answers to it depending on kind of your ambitions as well, and depending on, you know, how you want to run the company. I think for us, we care a lot about impact on a bigger scale, and we care about scale in general and growth and fast growth. So for us, you know, reaching profitability is not currently our kind of goal. It's not something we're talking about a lot in that sense, in terms of a near term, even 2 to 3 year sort of objective. It's more about making sure that the unit economics are working well, and that, you know, if we can in one city make sure that, you know, the operation runs profitably and efficiently, and then taking that to other markets over time. But this, I see this as like a 10-15 year type journey. And all of the big sort of benefits come with real scale for us. And so it will be a journey to get the profitability.
Is it actually difficult? Because I hear it all over the place and I experienced it also within my own company with Douglas. It's not easy to hire personnel, actually. It's like the market is empty. Yeah. Also for example, for our stores. Yeah. So beauty experts and sales experts for the stores. Is that a challenge when you scale now to new cities to find enough people?
I would just put people as the top priority almost for anyone building a company. And for me, it certainly is the top priority. I think everything sort of begins with people and the team. Mm-hmm. And so we put a lot of effort on that and hiring the best people, hiring probably less people, but great people, and then also paying them really well. So we are not trying to compromise too much when it comes to paying people. We think, you know, compensation is a kind of hygiene factor, but today you have a global pool of talent. You have people who can choose to work for, you know, other amazing companies, right? So you have, you know, next to our mission, like that's the way we talk about it internally, is like next to Dance's amazing mission, you know, which is about city transformation, all these exciting things. Unfortunately, you have, you know, many other very exciting missions out there and many exciting other companies out there. And so we see, you know, the compensation part of that is we don't have illusions around it. We think that, you know, that's a hygiene factor and we need to do very well there versus competition and then still have a very exciting mission and, you know, purpose-driven company and all of these other great things. But so that's how I think about that. And if you have that mindset, I think that you are able to attract, you know, we have certainly been able to attract great talent so far. And also locally in the cities, we've had success so far, but also we're still a small company. We're less than 100 people. So it's...
And for the service part, so when you call or when your bike is stolen or broken, and then the team has to come and to pick the bike, and so this more operational work?
Totally. So far we have been successful at hiring people for the operations team. This is, of course, I mean, it's the early beginnings for us, and there are also differences locally per market. So we've just launched Vienna and Paris, for example, and we're still.
And when
you
launch, how many bikes do you start a new city?
We've started now with a couple of hundred bikes in each of the cities, but we also have a steady stream of bikes coming into these locations over time.
Interesting. Yeah. And you always co-founded. So is that easier to do that with your friends or with somebody together?
I would personally never want to run a company myself. So I think for me, it's very important to have great partners along for the journey and in sort of for the long term as well. I don't want to be alone, sort of carrying the heavy burden of running a company. So I really enjoy that. It's been amazing working now with Christian and Alex. So Alex, my co-founder for SoundCloud, he's now the chairman at SoundCloud on the board level. So he's not operational day to day in SoundCloud, and he has the same role at Dance. So he's also our chairman of the board, but he's not running the company day to day. So Christian and I are the ones who do that. And I think, you know, it's for me, it's pretty critical. And I mean, you see it in the statistics as well, right? It's just harder to succeed if you're a single founder. It's one of my top sort of questions, I guess, I ask, you know, founders who come to me is, who are your co-founders, right? Because a founder has one certain profile and they need complementary co-founders. And I think it's a skill set, right, to find the right co-founder. And that's an important first step in my view. Of course, there are exceptions. There, you know, some of the best companies have single founders, but that's rather exceptions than the rule.
And why are so few female founders or co-founders in your view?
Yeah, that's a complex question, right? That is a big one. I mean, the world certainly needs more female founders. There's no doubt about that. I think, you know, there has been some positive change in that area. I've certainly backed more female founders in the kind of recent few years now. So there is, you know, that's interesting. There are also more female-led funds, which I think is exciting, mm-hmm. because those are kind of two things that are intimately connected, right? I think, you know, a female-led fund will, you know, more easily inspire female-led mm-hmm. founders, or that's just really important thing. I think, you know, it's really a question about that starts very early years, I think, for people as mm-hmm. well, and starts with the school system, right? And starts with the social context and so on. And unfortunately, in Sweden, where I'm from, I think, you know, situation is maybe somewhat better, and we have a great, you know, level of emancipation in Sweden, but still the amount of female founders is not super high. And so
even not in Sweden. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And so I think, you know, this is a big question, and I don't know the right answer to it.
That's a question which is, very actual and very much discussed. And I see it the same way. When you start funds which are supporting specifically startups where you have female founders or co-founders, I think it will help, yeah. Because it's from the investment side, it's very male. From the founder side, it's very male. So somehow you have to break the pattern, yeah. And to create new role models also from in the investor world, in the venture world, but also in the founder world, in my view. Yeah.
I agree. And I think the role models part is missing. And I can share a tip of a podcast called Role Models. It's done by a friend of mine who I used to work with at SoundCloud, David Noel. And
I was in that podcast too. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. And it's a great podcast. Yeah, I have to say. Yeah. Great people, yeah. And how did you raise the money? So at the very beginning, yeah, was it difficult to find investors? Or because you hear today, or let me say maybe a couple of months ago, before the Ukraine war started, you hear, well, okay, it's so easy to get money. Yeah? It's as an investor, it's now a huge competition. But from a startup perspective, it's very easy to get investors. How do you see that?
I mean, when I founded SoundCloud, which is now almost 15 years ago, there was a scarcity in sort of, you know, investors, certainly in the Berlin ecosystem. And you always sort of had to make a trip to London or to the Bay Area in order to secure financing. Today, we have almost like an abundance of capital out there. It's really changed quite a bit. I talked to a VC, senior VC, not long ago, and he said that everything has sort of one or two zeros additionally on them today. So in terms of the money available, the funds available, the companies available, it's just incredible what an explosion we've seen kind of in the European tech ecosystem, but of course also the world over the last sort of decades or two. So the situation is kind of a dynamic one, and it's changing. And I would say that, yes, it's quite easy to secure early stage financing these days. It gets a little bit more tricky once you get to the later stages. And certainly in Europe, we have a little bit of a gap there. So there's less availability of capital sort of when you get to the, you know, 50 plus million type region. But for early stage, I think it's changed and it's become incredibly founder friendly. I see more and more people also doing just safe notes, right? So convertible notes, and, you know, the valuations are really high. And so the tables have turned in many ways. And I think that's a great thing. You know, I think that's wonderful for entrepreneurship and, you know, for the ecosystem.
And how do you create now the brand awareness? So what kind of advertising do you, or advertising measures do you use for Dance?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very good question. Again, I think we are trying a ton of different things. And I think the name of the game for me is really iteration, you know, iterating and learning. So can we have a very data-rich environment internally? Can we have, you know, faster cycles internally and look at data and have a discussion about it and then act on it. So I think that's an important part of it, regardless of, you know, what kind of data it is, right? Sometimes you just have some anecdotes and you just talk to some customers or you can get data in any kind of way, but some data or some sort of evidence is better than nothing. And we are right now testing a lot of different things, ranging from different, you know, versions of online marketing, of course, to product-led growth. We're doing work on like the referral scheme internally, so you can refer the product. We look testing different incentives for that. We are also doing traditional advertising, like out-of-home advertising in cities and things like that, so testing that. And video, we're also doing influencer marketing, so talking to influencers. One of the things that we did was with the companies, we got a lot of individuals on board as investors in Dance, and that's something we actually spent a lot of time on. And the way we did that was we just got people engaged as financial investors, so we didn't have any sort of sweat equity deals or anything like that where people are supposed to do things for us. We just want people who are value aligned, who believe in what we're doing. And then in some cases, they've been able to help us, right? And so that's been, you know, another thing we've been doing. But frankly, it's, you know, it's a lot of blocking and tackling right now and just sort of, you know,
A-B testing and learning and getting the data and PR, because I think PR was very decisive for your startup. Not in the classical PR, but more in the corporate PR. So to talk about your startup, was I think quite decisive. Yeah, to attract different target groups, and I think the business target group is a very interesting target group for you, because they are all interested in e-bikes.
Totally. I mean, I think PR, I didn't mention it. I think it's one of the most important things. Mm-hmm. Like, we've worked a lot of PR and brand, right? So really making sure we understand what the brand is about and how we appear in the world. And then also what are our kind of key messages, and then really spending, you know, actually making sure we are actually, you know, working with the best PR agencies also locally. So, for example, here in Paris, I've done a lot of interviews now, and you don't see the results necessarily directly. It's very, you know, sometimes a little bit fuzzy, but then, you know, over the weeks and months, then it sort of starts to trickle in. People say, you know, oh, I read about you here, I heard about you there. And then for us, it's also about positioning ourselves next to all of these other already established companies, right? So be part of the conversation. And I think a lot of startups are not spending enough time on that. They're sort of not investing in PR and getting the word out. So that's something we did already quite a bit with SoundCloud, especially in the early days. And so we have experience with it.
Yeah, I think PR can be very powerful, especially in that stage. And also you talked about some prominent business angels, yeah? So I think that is also helping to create awareness in their network at the end, yeah.
Totally, totally. And I think, you know, it's something I observe when, you know, when I built SoundCloud, the first 2 years of building SoundCloud, I spent, you know, writing code, right? And looking at the product and obsessing about the product. And luckily, my co-founder, Alex, he was more focused on, you know, also getting the word out, and sort of I would say these days he's somewhat of a PR mastermind. Like, he really knows how to play that game, but it's a skill set, and it's something you actually need to spend a lot of time on, a lot of money on, alongside of the product work, right? Because there's a lot of, I mean, I'm trained as an engineer, and a lot of sort of people who are, you know, technical are sort of spend a lot of time on the product, but then forget all about, you know, the how do you go to market, right? And how do you talk about the product?
Yeah, exactly.
It's very simple.
I think the good product is the precondition, but it's more and more a hygiene factor. And then you have to create the brand, the positioning, the world around your product, yeah. How long did it take from the idea to the first product?
Yeah. So the company exists a little over 2 years now, and it took us about sort of 3 months to make the decision from sort of having the original idea to then actually, you know, for me to then somewhere along the way, pretty early in that process, meeting Christian and then us exploring and, you know, learning about the space. And so we made the decision to start the company then. And then pretty quickly after that, we started engaging with some experts on in the e-bike space and talked to manufacturing partners and so on. And I'm proud to say that almost, you know, a little over a year, we had from the first sort of kind of concept ideas about what the product should be to actually having the hardware product on the streets is what it took. And I think we optimized for time to market and learning, right? So we didn't want to build a perfect product from right away, which, you know, you can take different approaches to that. For us, it was important to get the first signal, real signal from the market, and then, you know, allow ourselves more time for the next iterations. It took a little over a year to have everything kind of ready and built.
And did you do any market research? So did you test the concept, the idea, or not at all? Or the bike?
In parallel to developing our own product, which took call it 14 months in total, from beginning to end, we had a pilot running. So we had hundreds of customers on other bikes. So we bought hundreds of bikes and we tested with live customers in Berlin. So we had a kind of under the radar pilot with about 200 customers. And we talked to them constantly. So we talked, you know, every week. We even have, you know, people who we hired who were just interviewing and kind of cataloging the feedback, really. And so that was then feeding into the design process. And that's how we were able to create something that we think is a really good, you know, version one, essentially, of the product. And also, of course, all of the software along with it. But we also know that, you know, this is just the first version, right? This is one of the nice things about being a subscription service is we can iterate on both kind of the software and the hardware aspects of it. And so we can just, you know, seed new products into the customer base.
And how do you see competition? Because there are some similar models, actually. Is it now a race in terms of expanding and scaling very fastly to be first in new cities? Or are you quite comfortable with regard to competition?
I see it as, I mean, it's an interesting one because in, you know, in VC and in software in particular, there's this very common dynamic where you have strong either like network effects or scale effects or lock-in effects, and you have a kind of a big market and you have a big prize at the other end of it. So there's a race and it goes on for, you know, 5 or 10 years. And then at the end of it, there's this big prize because you lock in a big portion of the market, you know, the winner take all, like that kind of stuff. So then people pour a ton of money on it and they, you know, they just try to win it at all costs. And sometimes, you know, it leads to this crazy reckless sort of spending and levels, which, you know, kind of makes sense because the prize is so big on the other side. I think in our case, we're kind of somewhere in the middle of that. So I don't see the sort of craziness that has happened in some other categories, right? Where it's quick commerce or even the shared micromobility stuff where like billions were basically being dropped within 3 years on, you know, and there were just so many competitors and things. I think this model is more of a kind of marathon race. And I think it's more of a sustainable sort of build over time. We think it's going to be a massive, you know, massive segment next to like shared micromobility and owned micromobility. We think essentially subscription will be like the third very meaningful pillar in there. But that's, you know, very early and nascent. That said, I think things will hit the kind of inflection point once there are enough proof points that you know, there's something really big here. And then I think we'll see more competition kind of coming into the space. I don't think it's going to be a winner-take-all situation. I think you're going to have a few different lanes, few different players, and maybe some geographical, you know, dominance as well. So I think, it's competitive. Certainly in Paris, it's more competitive, for example, than in Berlin. So we have a few different players here in Paris, but and that's a good thing. You know, I of course, you know, if if there wouldn't be any competition, it would be a bad sign, right? Yeah. So Paris is the torture test.
If you make it in Paris, you can make it everywhere.
Yes, I think so. I agree with that.
And you are going to Vienna, or you are already in Vienna and Hamburg. And why Hamburg and not Düsseldorf, for example?
So we launched in Berlin originally, and then recently launched in Hamburg and Munich in Germany, and then very recently launched in Vienna and Paris as well. So we now are officially a kind of a global platform across several countries. And we want to focus on, you know, trend-setting cities, bigger cities, cities with the right trajectory in terms of micromobility. Hamburg is, of course, sort of the probably or arguably second biggest, you know, most important market in Germany. My co-founder, Christian, is based in Hamburg. So we have, you know, we have great network in Hamburg. We think it's an important market, and we wanted to go a little bit deeper on Germany versus just doing, you know, one city. Berlin is also a very special place, right? Because the, you know, the GDP per capita, or like the propensity to pay basically in Berlin, is fairly low compared to Hamburg, Munich, even Vienna and Paris, right? So, for a more premium product like dance, it's the question, how big is the market in Berlin, right? So far, things are going very well, but it remains to be seen, you know, which city is the best. And I think for us, the approach we took was, we want to go to a few sort of trend-setting, great, you know, markets, not too many too soon and not too few. We want to be somewhere in the middle so we can test and see, you know, what type of city makes sense and how can we be successful.
And did you already launch the B2B part? So for companies in Berlin already, or also in other cities?
So in Germany, that is now live and it's working. So we're doing that in Germany, and we hope to bring it to Austria and France soon as well. We're seeing a lot of interest in that. It's very early, but it means that you as an employer can bring dance to your employees as a customer or as an employee benefit, either as a fully, you know, subsidized offer by the company, or something that is a kind of a pre-tax benefit for the employee. So it ends up being cheaper. I think that's a very exciting, you know, way for us to grow. But it's very early. We just launched like a couple of weeks ago.
Early stage, yeah. And the biggest challenge you have now, so what keeps you up during the night? So in the phase you are now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that has kept us up at night for the last 2 years have been the kind of global exceptional state of kind of electronics supply chains and bike supply chains and global logistics. So that's been and continues to be a challenge. So we're watching that very carefully. We're trying to, you know, have backups and then backups to the backups of our, you know, supply chains. So that's like, we put a lot of attention on that. But of course, you know, for me, I'm interested in, you know, do we have product market fit, right? It's very early for us. Like, we are seeing a lot of traction now. We're seeing, you know, great growth, but how is that sustained, right? Like, what are the feedback points, you know, on the product, and will that be enough? And can we iterate fast enough, you know, to adapt?
I suppose you are kind of a role model in the startup scene because you founded already very successfully. Yeah, you exited very successfully. Now the next startup you founded. If you give tips to your network or community, what are the three best tips from Eric to the community when you want to found or when you want to realize your own idea and create your own startup?
Yeah, it's funny because when someone asks that, and it happens occasionally, then there's always this memory that I have when we were, you know, Alex and I were in Stanford. We actually did our thesis work in the Bay Area back in 2006, and we went to Stanford to see this Indian entrepreneur there who's quite successful, and he, you know, we asked him that question, and he said, your top three top three thing you should have is focus, and focus. And it was, you know, it's something that stuck with me because it is very hard to keep focused. Mm. And by focus, I mean just simply do fewer things and do them well and sort of try to invest more and be bold enough to invest more behind a few things and not, you know, stretch yourself too thin and, you know, do too many things. There's, of course, another thing, which is you should also throw some things at the wall. So there's a tension there, right? Like when it's early, you need to test a few things as well. But then really try to learn quickly what works and then, you know, don't do the things that don't and you know, put more weight behind, you know, the things that do work. But the other things that I would say are pretty much that it's very important, to me, it's very important to have a strong purpose with what you do. So mm-hmm. really kind of look inside yourself, think mm-hmm. about, you know, what is something meaningful that you would want to spend, you know, the next 10 years doing. I think that's very important. And then, as we talked about before, get a co-founder. Find someone to do it with, or several people to do it with. I think that's a lot more fun than being alone on a mission.
And personally, where do you get your inspiration? So how can I imagine, Eric, what are you reading, listening? What are you, to whom are you talking to get inspired?
Yeah, I mean, 2019, right, when I had my sabbatical was a tough year, you know, in many ways, mm-hmm. because I, you know, what I realized when I, soon after I had left, you know, I came at some point, was sitting, I actually went road biking in Mallorca. And so I spent, you know, a week sort of just road biking. And after that, I had some friends who were running a small co-working space in Palma. And so I came into the co-working space and they gave me a desk and, you know, I had my laptop. I pull up my laptop, I opened it and I realized that it's only me and my laptop again after, you know, 12, 13, 14 years, you know, having hundreds of people in my organization. And it was a very odd feeling of being sort of completely alone, essentially unemployed, right? Mm. And sort of completely without a mission. So in some ways, it was a little bit desperate at times there in 2019, because I was just turning stones, trying to find, you know, the next thing. And it's hard, right? Mm. It's very hard to find an original idea, you know, that isn't, you know, crazy enough that, you know, you actually think it can be done, and where you match as a person as well, that you, you know, will want to do. So I try to be, you know, to find a kind of formula of how to discover that. And I did a few workshops with people as well. So just, you know, interesting people who I met sort of along the way, and we just explored mm-hmm. quite broadly. I did long walks, you know, but the truth is that I guess when it comes to reading and listening and watching things, and it's very eclectic for me. Like I couldn't say that I'm very deep on, you know, this particular category. It's a very it's a very eclectic. If you look at my, you know, my library or yeah.
And how did your wife accompany in this period between SoundCloud and dance?
Yeah, so my wife, Sophie, she also runs a company. So she's an entrepreneur. She's mm-hmm. been doing that for a long time as well. And she understands, right? So she has a lot of empathy for that. She also is on her second company. And she gave me a lot of freedom to go and explore and go and travel. And I think I really, you know, appreciated that a lot. She had a lot of discussions with me, you know, where at some point she was saying, like, now you really have to find something, like, this doesn't work anymore. You know, you kind of, you know, you're just, you're sounding desperate. So there were definitely a few moments like that where, like, you know, you wonder sort of like, will I ever find something, right? But my advice would be turn stones, right? Mm. It's sort of how this happened, like, you know, I met someone in summer and we talked about solar panels and solar deployment. And then I went to this design symposium in Stockholm and it was super boring. And I ended up leaving it early and texted my friend. We went on a 5-hour walk through Stockholm. That was, you know, this long, epic walk. And at some point he turned around, and, you know, we were talking about renting versus owning things. You know, we were talking about this hypothetical, could you rent a toaster, for example, all kinds of weird appliances, right? And then he turns around and said, couldn't you rent an e-bike? And then, you know, my first response was like, yeah, but that's so obvious, someone is already doing it, right? and then I made a little note, and then we sort of continued talking, but then I, you know, started looking at it. And then the funny thing was that I met this guy again, kind of randomly, who I was talking with about solar panels. And then he told me that there is this other person who told me very recently that he's exploring something very similar. And then we met, you know, and it felt like this very long shot thing that you wouldn't, you know, maybe some people wouldn't follow up on it, but I did. And I think I've had that experience oftentimes where like you turn this one more stone or you go one extra step, and there all of a sudden the answer, you know, lies, right? Where it's this, you know, Woody Allen quote, right? Like half of success is showing up, right? It's just...
Yeah.
Show up, right?
Yeah. It's like 95% is execution and 5% strategy.
Sure.
It goes a bit into the same direction, as you say, turning the stones. And is once you found it, isn't it then also all about resilience and keep on focusing? Yeah, you said it, focus, but then just execute and... A/B testing all the time, but keep the track. Yeah.
Yes, I mean there's definitely a lot of persistence involved for sure with anything or with any company, and that to me again it brings me back to the mission. Right, I need to be able to kind of reflect on what we're doing and feel that it's meaningful. And if I feel it isn't meaningful, then you know, or if you feel that, I think you should think about, you know, whether how much longer are you going to do it, right? And I think you need to be honest to yourself about that. So that's the key thing. But if I have that strong purpose, I can run for a very long time.
Yeah.
So that's sort of, and I really enjoy it. You know, it's sort of the thing that I enjoy the most is just we have such amazing people on the team, right? We've made no compromises. We've just hired the best people and they're amazing people and just fun to work with them, right? So this is...
Yeah, thanks a lot for those insights. I think it's very valuable to all the listeners. As this podcast is called Beauty and Beyond, we have to talk a minute about beauty. So what is, in your sense, what is beauty? Who is beautiful in your view?
I mean, who is beautiful? It's obviously, there are two people in my life right now, and that is my wife, of course, and then our son, right?
Yeah,
so he's two years old, and he's just incredibly cute, and just, you know, he's starting to communicate a lot in a mix of Swedish, German, and English, which is just, you know, when he's waking us up with this mix of Swedish, English, German songs in the morning at like 5:30 a.m. is just amazing, right? So that is, you know, that is definitely, or those are the two most beautiful people in my life right now, and I spend a lot of time with them.
And to beautify yourself, how do you see yourself? Do you invest into your beauty, into your outer experience? Let's put it this way.
Well, the short answer is I don't do that much, right? So, and I have a kind of a somewhat a dualistic kind of relationship to that, because of course I care about my own appearance to some extent, but also I keep deprioritizing it, right? So I end up not spending enough time on that. I've had a few, you know, attempts to kind of talk to, I don't know, stylists and things like this, but it never sort of came to anything really, because I think it's really ultimately on me just not sort of investing enough time in myself. That said, I mean, I'm someone who likes beauty generally in the world. Like, I think, you know, increasingly nature for me, and of course then architecture, design, and music and the arts, like it's all very important things to me. And yeah, and I keep, you know, now I'm in Paris, right? And I'm you know, walking the streets of Paris, and it's just a city of where
fashion.
So many people are very stylish, right? And then they just have this amazing sort of aura around them, which, you know, I'm more of a uniform kind of person. I just have, you know, certain few sort of garments, and I wear them sort of all the time, which, you know, in some part of me wants to break away from that, but part of me is just accepting that.
So maybe we can help you to break away.
Sure.
I'm sure we have enough in our assortment to help you.
Yeah.
And so Eric, thank you very much. I think it was great insights for all who maybe think about founding a company, realizing own ideas, jumping into the cold water. You know, it's easily said. I spent my whole career in very big companies. Yeah. Also, Douglas is quite a big company. And but I'm very interested in that in the startup scene, and also now doing the first steps as investor, as business angel investor. And there are so many great ideas out there. And I have to say, I was from the first moment on, I was intrigued by your business idea, by your concept, and by the bike. And hopefully soon I give you the live feedback how the ride on the bike is. So congratulations. I think you bring something to a livable, to make a city more livable. It's in the mega trend of healthy lifestyle, of sustainability, of making our cities again a great place to live and to work as well. We are also thinking a lot about the cities because of retailing, because of our stores. Yeah, and stores are only a part of the city. And somehow we have to make the cities, or we have to transform the cities, that people are going back also to the cities, yeah, and feel at ease and enjoy and experience things in the cities, yeah. And that's why Dan's and Douglas has a lot in common, yeah. If you look at the customer we serve, yeah.
Definitely, yeah. Lots to think about there, yeah.
So I wish you all the best for Dance. Great expansion, a lot of fun with you and your team. And then see you soon on the bike.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on the podcast. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
All the best. Bye-bye. Ciao.
Bye.